Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We're joining us now by telephone is professor at Drake University, Ismael Hossein Sate. He is the author of a new book called The Political Economy of U.S. Militarism, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thanks for being with us. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you and your listeners this morning.
You devote this book to really describing and analyzing the militarization of American foreign policy. First of all, what do you mean by that, and how long has this been going on?
Well, militarization of foreign policy basically means that it is largely the Pentagon and its contractors who are making policies on war and peace. And they have the Pentagon has increasingly nudged away the State Department as the major foreign policy institution. Furthermore, it means that the resident of the White House, that is the president, or presidents, do not make much of a change from one president to the next, because major policy decisions. That is, foreign policy decisions are made by the Pentagon, or more specifically by the so-called military-industrial complex. That is, the Pentagon, its contractors, and the key congressional committees, who are, by the way, essentially in the pockets of these contractors. For example, five out of six major contributors to the election of members of the House Foreign Relations Committee, as well as to the Senate Armed Services Committee, were Pentagon contractors like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Bechtel, Halliburton, you name it. So that's what I mean, that war profiteers are also war makers.
Now, how long has this been going on? Is this something that goes very far back in our nation's history?
Not really. In fact, this is basically a post-World War II development. Prior to that, that is over 150 or 65 years, U.S. politicians and the United States in general was very anti-militaristic. That is, they were averse or opposed to maintaining a large military establishment during time of peace. And that's why, after every war, and the United States had many of those wars, at the end of each war, they demobilized the wartime military force to pre-war level until World War II. And that's why, on the eve of World War II, U.S. armed forces were merely 139,000 personnel, which is one-tenth of what we have now. So this, militarism, that is, of course, militarism is different than military or military force. Military force is a means for other ends, for territorial conquest, for national defense, for economic gains. But the use of military on a protracted basis for those ends after World War II gradually led to this huge apparatus, which has become an end in itself. In other words, it has become a bureaucratic empire in its own right, to the extent that now recent wars of choice are driven largely by these huge arms manufacturers, arms conglomerates. And this is, by the way, something that the late President Eisenhower warned the nation in his farewell address in 1951. So he warned that the day might come that our external military adventures might be driven not so much by a national security or national interest, but by corporate profitability and the need to make huge profits.
And you make that case in your book, but before you do, you give four other explanations that are quite popular for the reasons for the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. Let's go through those four explanations that people tend to give. For example, that it's about oil, or that it's about a neoconservative ideology, or that it's about Israel, or that it's about President Bush wanting war because he wants to be a war president. Talk about each one of those.
I will be glad to. Well, let's first look at the issue that is in everyone's mind when it comes to war in the Middle East. Everybody says that it is for oil. Well, I don't deny that oil is a concern. Neither do I deny the fact that in the past, both the United States and European powers used military force for energy purposes. But it does not follow from that therefore the current military adventures in the region, especially the invasion of Iraq, were prompted by big oil. In fact, there is evidence that the big oil was very reluctant to invade Iraq because they prefer stability and predictability, that is long-term planning, to short-term spikes or hikes in oil prices. Of course, they welcome those high oil prices because they have become made fortunes. But they were originally reluctant because they have lost, although they are making fortunes, but they also have lost vast investment markets like in Iran, in Russia, in Venezuela, and other places, largely because war has created these conflicts and insecurity. So in my view, while oil may be a factor, but it is used more as a pretext, as an excuse, which is because it's a national concern, in order to camouflage or to hide a stronger interest that is basically war profiteering. You see, for every dollar worth of oil that we import from the Middle East, we are spending $6 allegedly to protect that oil. So furthermore, oil exporting countries, they need as much to export to sell their oil as much we need. So therefore, in the absence of war and international convulsion, there is no need that we wouldn't get oil. So that's my argument about oil. Then on the issue of neoconservatives, which everybody says they are the driving force behind war and militarism. Again, I don't deny that neoconservatives have played a crucial role. But the issue does not stop there. The more fundamental question is, what are the forces behind neoconservatives? Whom or what do they represent? And when you look into that question, you will see that these neoconservative figures, like Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, William Crystal, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, they all have their roots and affiliations with these jingoistic, bellicose think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, Project for the New American Century, and a dozen or more of such think tanks who have been not only funded, but in fact founded by Pentagon contractors. And there you see the relationship between neoconservatives who work within these think tanks and then the support and the funding of those think tanks by by Pentagon contractors and war profiteers. To give you another example of that, dubious or even incestuous relationship, business relationship, suffice it to say that 32 of major policymakers and advisors and appointees of the first term of Bush, of this President Bush, 32 of them were picked from among those who had served as consultants or advisors or executives of Pentagon contractors. So that's why I think that neoconservatives are basically loudspeakers or public relations personnel or a facade of these major but largely submerged forces of war profiteering.
Okay, what about the Israel argument?
The Israel argument is slightly different because the role that pro-Israel lobby is playing is, I think, is very important. I think after the military-industrial complex and war profiteering, the role of pro-Israel lobby is the most important and most crucial in the invasion of Iraq and other conflicts in the Middle East. There is a convergence of interests between the interests of pro-Israel lobby, that is hardcore Zionist forces, and beneficiaries of war. And that's why there has been a de facto unofficial collaboration between these two forces.
What do you mean by that more specifically? Beneficiaries of war and that?
Beneficiaries of war, I mean war profiteers, Pentagon contractors.
Are connected to the Israel lobby?
No, they collaborate and cooperate unofficially and in practice, but there is no official connection. And that cooperation is because there is a convergence of their interest on war and political turbulence in the Middle East. You see, those who benefit from war, that is Pentagon contractors, like war and the political turbulence in order to continuously increase military spending. But the pro-Israel lobby also is afraid of peace in the Middle East, because if they see that if Israel is forced to sit around the table and listen to peace negotiations, the first thing that would be suggested is to implement dozens of United Nations resolutions that say that Israel should go back to pre-1967 borders. And that's why they are afraid of peace, and they want to create turbulence and confusion and conflict so that under the pretext of war atmosphere, they can continue to maintain occupation and further develop new settlements. So therefore, in my view, you see that both forces, the Israeli lobby and the armaments lobby, they both see their interests served not through peace, but through war and political turbulence in the Middle East. And that's why they collaborate and cooperate in rekindling that war and military adventures.
We're speaking.
So now, having said that,
go ahead.
Having said that, I must add that I disagree with the view that, therefore, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is made in Jerusalem, or that the relationship between the United States and Israel is a case of tail wagging the dog. I disagree with that. I think U.S. foreign policymakers go along with the wishes and desires of Zionist project because there is a convergence of interests, because they play into each other's hands. In other words, they are too strong and too smart to be misled or misguided or fooled by Israeli lobby.
We're talking to Professor Ismail Hossein Sadeh, and his book is called The Political Economy of U.S. Militarism. Well, let's get into your argument, which goes beyond all of these theories that you've just been talking about. You focus on the industrial part of the military-industrial complex, and you describe really a capitalist military establishment existing in a real marketplace with the drive for sale and profits, the same as any other, you know, shoes or toasters or anything else, to the point where it's so huge that it's become its own empire, as you say, based in the Pentagon with civilian and military and private forces. How does this actually work? I mean, it's a little hard to imagine a group of men around a table saying, in a sort of Orwellian way, let us maintain a situation of constant war so that we can make money.
Well, it is not that simple, though. I don't want to simplify the issue or to be, let's say, reductionist, to say that this is all based on a conspiracy launched or maintained by a small group of plotters. You see, first of all, the issues of national security and the military being sacrosanct and patriotism are issues that hardly anybody can challenge. Secondly, it is not a small group of warmongers. It is rather the sad fact that almost our entire economy, millions of jobs and businesses and communities have become dependent on military spending. And that's why somebody, a politician, a worker, or a community organizer, or even an anti-war person, might be philosophically against increases in military spending, but they would hesitate to say so or to oppose increases in military spending because that would cause them businesses and jobs. Secondly, to the extent that that the military-industrial complex or war profiteers have been able to maintain and to expand this empire, this military-industrial complex, they do that in very subtle ways. They are not going to go to the Congress and say, we need more money. They always pave the way. They come up with pretexts in very subtle ways that nobody would resist expanding military spending. For example, in the Gulf, in the experience of Vietnam, they came up with that concocted story of the Gulf of Tonkin, that the U.S. ships were attacked by the Viet Cong, and that paved the way for war, the Vietnam War. Or currently, they are saying that in recent days, they have come up with a similar story, saying that the Iranian speedboats are harassing aggressively U.S. ships in the Persian Gulf, in the Strait of Hormuz.
Do you think that's another Gulf of Tonkin type of fabrication?
Well, I am not sure of that, but it smells or smacks of such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or, for example, in the case of Iraq, you remember all the evidence that was fabricated. You know, the uranium tubes from Africa and the weapons of mass destruction and collaboration between Saddam Hussein and Al Qaeda, all lies. So that's how they outmaneuver opponents of war in order to increase military spending. And as military spending goes up, more and more people become dependent on military spending. And that creates a vicious circle. The more military spending, the more dependence on military spending. And in the meantime, these giant manufacturers of armaments, they need to show the efficiency and productivity of what they produce through what they call shock and awe, through surgical operations, laser-guided bombs, in order to show the American people that they are not wasting their money. And such operations and military adventures in turn create a reaction on the part of those who have been subjected to such attacks, and hence this vicious circle. You see, it is a very very pernicious and perverse relationship between dependence on of jobs, or between military spending and war profiteering and international war and political conflict.
There's another vicious circle that you talk about, which is that there's a cycle of campaign contributions coming from these people to Congress, and Congress then gets to be very much part of that whole war profiteering cycle.
Exactly. There are two sides to that vicious circle, to that campaign contribution. One is contribution to the election of policymakers, especially key congressional committees like House Appropriations Committee and Senate Armed Services Committee. As I said, last year or the year before, five out of six top contributors to these committees were Pentagon contractors. But there is another side, and that is that in order to be reelected, they need to bring what is called, you know, metaphorically, it's called to bring bacon, or to bring money to their communities and their constituencies. And that's why, as I said, even those who are against war and military spending on ideological grounds would work hard to increase that spending in order to satisfy their communities and their constituencies.
Well, there's an irony to that, which you talk about in the book, which is that at the same time that communities, I mean, we have various installations like Los Alamos National Laboratories right next door to us here in Santa Fe, but at the same time, we have a draining of our larger economy for this militarism, to the point where we have a serious deficit that's a threat to our economy, and to the point where there's a real, you know, somewhat successful movement to cut back on social safety net programs and really kind of try to undo the New Deal.
Exactly. Well, that's a very important point. I think opponents of public sector spending or government spending on social issues were never happy with the New Deal reforms and social safety net programs. But because the economic consequences of those reforms in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s were so strong that these opponents kept quiet. But then in the 70s, they mobilized behind Ronald Reagan in late 1970s and brought him to the White House, and that's when they began to reverse the New Deal by deliberately creating huge budget deficits so that then social cuts will be imposed on Congress, which was dominated by Democrats at the time. And the way to create budget deficits was, or has been to this day even, it continues to this day, the way to create budget deficits in order to cut social spending is, one, to increase military spending, and two, to give huge tax cuts to the wealthy. So that's why increasing military spending has been accompanied by further lopsidedness or further aggravation of income inequality and social stratification. So, and that's why I think these recent wars of choice are, in essence, reflections of domestic fight over national resources. In other words, these wars abroad, these wars of choice, are not only destroying and looting or robbing people in other countries, let's say in Iraq, but they're also looting American people. They are robbing U.S. Treasury, that is tax dollars. And that's why And that's why military spending, although it may create some jobs and help businesses in the short run, in the long run, it is not good for the growth and development of our economy, of our society, because it comes at the expense of neglecting what is called social capital, what is called public works projects, for example, roads, levees, bridges, as well as it comes at the expense of neglecting human capital, like education, health, nutrition, housing. And these are the things that are needed for long-term growth and development. But disproportionately large military spending comes at the expense of these priorities. And that's why at the same time that our military spending is skyrocketing, our bridges and our roads and our education is languishing, and we are deep in debt to the tune of almost $9.5 trillion, which is close to U.S. GDP.
Right. We're talking to Ismail Hossein Zadeh, and the book is called The Political Economy of U.S. Militarism. You talked a moment ago about invented threats, and you talk in your book about the exaggeration of the communist threat and now the war on terror and so on. How do you think that citizens and honest people in power should be able to distinguish between an invented threat and a real threat to our country?
Well, that's a key issue, a key question. Well, as you pointed out, I bring undeniable evidence that even the threat of communism was largely perceived or fabricated than real. And that's why when the Soviet Union collapsed in late 1980s and early 1990s, the American people were very excited about the prospects of what they called, what came to be known as peace dividends. That is a reorientation of part of military spending towards more beneficial social spending. But that, of course, scared those who benefit from war and militarism. And as a result, they mobilized and came up with a major document which was written by Dick Cheney, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time under George W. Bush Sr., and his deputy at the time, which again was Paul Wolfowitz and other people. And that document was called Defense Planning Guidance. And that Defense Planning Guidance was, in essence, a reaction or a document to the end of the Cold War and the threat of peace dividend, that is, threat of peace dividends to those who benefit from war dividends, let's say. And in that document, all the major policy issues that 12 years later George W. Bush implemented, like regime change, preemptive strike, global terrorism, all these issues were laid out in that document 12 years earlier. But President Clinton basically ignored that document, and that's why when he left the White House and George W. Bush arrived in the White House with the authors of that document of early 1990s, they dusted off that document, replaced Dick Cheney's name with Donald Rumsfeld's name, and called it Bush Doctrine, and began to put into place what had been mapped out in the early 1990s.
No, I mean, point you're making, I understand, but again, this question of what's a real threat? I mean, the argument about all these invented threats, I think, is well taken, but are there not any real threats to the United States ever?
Well, I wouldn't say ever, but at this juncture, or in recent memory, there have been no threats against the United States. Iraq was no threat to the United States. Iran has never been a threat to the United States. even Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden to the extent that, well, they are threats. But it is wrong to call that war on the United States. Even the heinous attacks of 9/11, they were mass murdering criminal acts that needed to be tackled by the police, by judicial persecution and international intelligence cooperation.
So that gets into a very important question, is what do you think, I mean, we saw the response to 9/11 on the part of the Bush administration, but what do you think would have been the appropriate and proper and most effective response?
Well, as I just said, response to terrorism, and that was a terrorist act, no matter how heinous and terrible it was. The response to terrorist attacks have always been through police, international police cooperation, police work, intelligence work and cooperation, and judicial system. And that's why, for example, both the British and the Spanish, who have had during the last few years terrorist attacks, have been more successful in bringing the culprits and criminals to justice than the United States. But in the United States, if the 9/11 was not called war, then they couldn't justify their own war, and it would not have been as profitable to war profiteers, to the military-industrial complex. So, again, going back to your question more directly, when you say, what is a real threat? That reminds me of what the late General Smedley Butler, who served in the U.S. Armed Forces for more than 30 years. And when he retired, he wrote this brilliant pamphlet, which is called War is a Racket. And in that it says, war, except defending your homes and your territory, and defending the Constitution, war by any other name is a racket. And the fact is that in recent memory, the United States has never had a serious threat directed at its territory or anything else. In fact, the U.S. policies have always, in recent memory, have always created blowbacks or reactions that has jeopardized its markets and hurt its interests overseas. For example, many U.S. multinational corporations, that is, non-military transnational corporations like AOL Online, Starbucks Coffee, Pizza Hut, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, American Airlines, all brand name America products are losing markets in the Muslim world because of war and military adventures.
Now, there's an important point that you bring up that I thought it would be interesting to talk about, and that is the debate between the proponents of free trade, multilateral neoliberalism, which tends to be sort of Clinton Democrats, and then
right.
We had that in the 90s, and the proponents of neoconservative unilateralism that we know now, which is completely militarized or mostly militarized foreign policy. These are both forms of imperialism, and you know, part of the point of this book is that we are an empire like the British Empire, somewhat like the Roman Empire. How does each of those two forms of empire work, and what is the relationship between each one of these and the cycles of expansion and contraction of the U.S. economy?
Almost every major world power has always preached free trade and peaceful international commerce when they are competitive globally, that is, competitive economically and technologically. But once they lose that competitiveness, they resort to military power. That's a general statement, but going back to your question more specifically in the context of the United States at this juncture, I believe that there is a conflict of interest between the free marketeers or proponents of free market or non-military transnational capital on the one hand, and champions of military transnational capital, the nationalists and unilateralists on the other hand. This conflict was reflected a couple of years ago, for example, in a meeting in New York City, where when Donald Rumsfeld, as the Secretary of Defense, spoke about expanding U.S. military presence globally and praising the military prowess of the United States, executives of non-military transnational corporations like Bill Gates was sitting there and listening very tensely and frowning upon it. On the other hand, when Bill Gates stood up and spoke about peaceful coexistence and free trade without military intervention, then the military brass and Donald Rumsfeld were looking sullen and glum and frowning upon that. So in other words, these two factions within the U.S. ruling elite, those who are called multilateralists or neoliberals, who rely primarily on market forces on the one hand, and then champions of unilateralism, nationalism, and militarism who rely on military force on the other. At this juncture, proponents of free trade and those who lose markets, both in terms of investment and sales, are outmaneuvered by proponents of war and militarism. There is a group of businesses which is called USA Engage. If you Google search USA Engage, you will see their site, which has more than 800 companies, major transnational corporations, non-military transnational corporations, including many, many agribusiness and farming companies in my own state, in Iowa, who are lobbying for rapprochement and peaceful trade with Iran, with Russia, and other countries. But that would be, that would not be good for the business of war. And that's why their voices are overwhelmed by the voices of militarism and patriotism and nationalism.
And I think it's important to point out just in passing that the neoliberalist agenda is also not the is not sweetness and light for the rest of the world either, in the sense that there are a lot of Latin American countries that have specifically rebelled against it because it was an incursion not of U.S. military
right.
forces, but of U.S. economic forces that
exactly.
put their small farmers out of business or whatever, or Bechtel trying to control the water supply of Bolivia and so on. That's all part of neoliberal economics.
Exactly. No, I didn't mean to sanitize neoliberal policies of free trade. In fact, that's why, for the reason that you just mentioned, that is called free trade imperialism, meaning draining resources out of other countries through free trade, because smaller countries, less developed countries who cannot compete, they would lose. That's why they are rebelling. Almost all leading industrialized countries, starting with England in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, and then the United States, Japan, all these countries, when they were growing, they had policies of protection against their foreign competitors, the policies to protect their industry until they became competitive, a policy that was called infant industry protection. That is, you protect your industries while they are in a stage of infancy until they become mature and they become competitive. But now they are denying that to less developed countries under the pretext of free trade, which always they try to mix it with freedom in general.
Now, I want to move on to another point that I think is very important that you bring up in your book. You devote a chapter to the roots of the conflict between the Muslim world and the West, and, you know, the so-called clash of civilizations. What's the difference between the current government and pundit line on this and the way you see it?
Well, you see, when there are economic interests or economic motives to wage war or to keep the international relations turbulent and warlike, then you will always find excuses. You will find pretexts to invent, or if necessary, to manufacture new enemies. And during the Cold War, it was the threat of communism, real or perceived. Then after the threat, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and at the end of Cold War, and the demand for peace dividends in the United States, those who benefit from military spending, they came up with new enemies like rogue states, axis of evil, global terrorism, Islamic radicalism. So it is no accident that all these new enemies and new terminologies came to existence in post-Cold War period. Now, the theory of the clash of civilization, I don't know whether that theory was prompted by this objective or not, but the fact is that instead of looking at specific, real, concrete reasons for war and militarism, which are basically territorial, geopolitical, and economic, it tends to blame culture and religion, and in this case Islam, as a major factor in international conflicts. They argue that Islam is inherently incompatible with modernization, and therefore we have all these resistance and conflicts with the Muslim world. And the political or policy conclusion is that if we don't defeat this different and aggressive and violent culture, they would defeat us, they would devour us. And from there follows preemptive war and regime change. You see how dangerous this theory is.
Yeah,
now, this theory, on the face of it, when you look at daily violence in the Muslim world, you know, suicide bombing and terrorist behavior, you would say, oh, this makes sense. That's right. It's the culture. It's Islam. But when you look at the history, you will see that the Muslim world was very receptive and very welcoming the Western world for more than 150 years, you see? The Muslim world came into contact with the Western modern world more than two centuries ago. And for the first 150 or 60 or 70 years, we didn't have this so-called resurgence of our political Islam. Why is it, if Islam is inherently incompatible with modernization, why is it that we didn't see these reactions, these harsh reactions to Western powers for over 1.5 centuries, and only during the last few or several decades that we see that?
Well, and you point out that 100 years ago, or you quote Karen Armstrong is pointing this out, that every leading Muslim intellectual was in love with the West.
That's true. I have seen part of that history. You know, I'm not very young. I remember growing up in Kurdistan, Iran, 50 years ago, our textbooks were peppered with the pictures of U.S. states people, statesmen like FDR, JFK, and with aphorisms and sayings of the U.S. Constitution. People loved the United States. The reason was that at that time, the dominant power was the British imperialism, and the United States trying to nudge away that old imperial power was, at least on the face of it, sympathetic to the aspirations of less developed countries for economic development and national identity. So what changed that, all that receptiveness and love was none other than U.S. policies, because time and again they showed exploitative and heavy-handed policies. For example, you know, currently we see that in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, people see that all their leaders are appointed by them and kept in power by U.S. support. Look at Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan, Pakistan, Turkey. If it's not because of the U.S. support, none of these regimes would last very long. In fact, contrary to public perception, Iran is the most stable because the U.S. Has not been able, since the revolution, has not been able to interfere directly in its affairs. And that's why the United States does not like Iran.
Very interesting. I think we've got just a few minutes left. I think it's worth pointing out a couple of things, even though they're probably obvious. And the first is that every penny that goes into this vast military-industrial empire that we've been talking about for this hour comes, by definition, out of the pockets of taxpayers.
Mm.
And the second is that death and terror and chaos are the inevitable results of selling war implements, just as watching TV is the inevitable result of selling televisions.
Exactly. That's right. You know, as I said earlier, producers of war industries or of instruments of destruction, they advertise their efficiency and productivity through death and destruction. And that's why they have these, they have turned war into like a game. Shock and awe, laser-guided bombing, surgical operations. And you're right. And also, as you said, every dollar that is spent on these destructive means is a dollar taken away from education, from health, from nutrition. So again, these wars destroy and deprive not only people in other countries, for example, in Iraq, but equally they are undermining the foundation of American economy, American society, American culture, and it comes down to basically using war and military adventures as an insidious, subtle way of robbing or looting the American people of their resources, of their tax dollars.
So we've got 2 minutes left. What is to be done?
Well, again, I will have to go back to the late General Smedley Butler, the author of War is a Racket, who said the only way to end wars of choice, and by that he meant every war except war for the Constitution and for your homes and territory. He said the effective way to end wars of choice is to take profits out of war. In other words, war industries should be owned and operated by the public, not by these private conglomerates, which are subject to market imperatives and profitability. And this is not an outlandish projection or a statement, because under previous empires, and even now, many countries have their military industries owned and operated by the public sector, which is free of, in which wars are not driven by profits. To that statement by General Butler, I would add something else, and that is to take money out of elections. So
yes.
By taking money out of war and taking money out of elections, hopefully the pernicious driving force, which is profits, will no longer be there, and we will hopefully have peace and international understanding.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending this hour with us. Ismael José Insadeh is professor of economics at Drake University and the author of the book The Political Economy of U.S. Militarism, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much.
Surely. I thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.